It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, it's traveling time. We're in the thick of winter now, so maybe you're busy making adventurous cold weather getaway plans, or maybe you're just dreaming of them. Travel writer Tony Perrottet has spent his career traveling all over the globe, but he always chose exotic places like Tierra del Fuego or the Amazon over plain old Paris or Rome, until he discovered the oldest surviving guidebook at the New York Public Library, and that launched him on his most exotic journey yet, in the footsteps of the ancients. He told Steve Paulson that nothing has much changed since the Romans invented tourism.
Literature has a litany of complaints about inns in ancient times, about their rock-hard mattresses and their leaky roofs and the staff who are sullen and surly and the innkeepers who are demented. And at all these places, you could also get food as well. There were little restaurants in all these inns. And much like today, people would complain about the food. There were always rumours of human flesh turning up in the stews and knuckle bones and things like that. And in fact, the people who stayed in these inns as well, there was Plutarch is always complaining about the company that you would find yourself stuck with at night. And he actually advises that you hum to yourself in the dining room to drown out the drivel of the other travelers.
So once you actually started to read about all of this stuff, you did something rather unusual. You retraced the route of these ancient Roman tourists. So why did you want to do that?
I'd always loved ancient history, and I had studied Latin and Greek back in Australia, where I was brought up. And I had actually intended to go, naturally, to see the great sites of Italy and Greece and Asia Minor and Egypt. But when I left Australia, I made it as far as India, and it was so fascinating and so amazing and so cheap that I ended up staying for months. And I began to see the Mediterranean as a place that had been so overrun by tourists since the 1960s. There was nothing new or fresh that I could see there. So once I found all this information, I thought, what an incredible way to see the Mediterranean in a fresh way, looking at it through the eyes of the ancient tourists, and in fact, going to all these places that were in fact identified as tourist sites first by the ancient Romans.
What was the general route that you took?
Following the greatest hits of the Romans, really, which is really, if you were doing a Wonders of the Mediterranean tour today, it's very similar. They started off in Rome, obviously, and then it was a very easy run along the Via Appia down to the Bay of Naples, which was the first great seaside resort of antiquity, and that was where the beautiful villas were, and that was where it was very sensual and hedonistic lifestyle. It was the first real association of sun, sand, and sex. Everyone would just hang there for the summer, and they would eat an incipient form of bouillabaisse bays by the water and swim in these beautiful little bays, protected bays that they built. From there, they would then go to Greece, which was kind of like the old world for the Romans. And so they would start off in Athens, where the philosophers had all lived and spoken, and they would go to the Academy of Plato, and they'd go to Socrates' birthplace and things like that. They would go to Delphi, where the Oracle of Apollo had been. And then they would cut across the Aegean, hopping in merchant ships, much as we sort of go on these little Greek ferries today. And they would go over to the coast of Asia Minor, which is now Turkey. The goal was to go to Troy. And for Romans, that was like the Jerusalem of ancient times. They, having read Homer, they loved to go to the site where all this had occurred. And they could actually, there were little battlefield tours where people would show them around, where all the events had occurred, where Priam had fallen, where Achilles had chased Hector around the walls and things like that.
And that was all, I suppose, very real history for them. I mean, this was just some ancient mythological kind of site that they were visiting.
No, absolutely, absolutely. There was very little distinction made between history and mythology. It all blurred and overlapped. And to actually be on this place that they'd read about since childhood was an extraordinary thing for them. And they would go around and they would carry their copies of Homer, and most of them actually knew it all by heart. But anyway, from Troy, they would head down to Egypt, and Egypt was very unusual and it was incredibly exotic. Mostly Romans weren't that interested in other cultures. They thought the Greco-Roman culture was the best. But Egypt, it was just so undeniably ancient and so undeniably bizarre that it was an ongoing fascination for Romans. But there you would hire guides and you would arrange a Nile cruise, basically. And from Alexandria, you could just go up to the pyramids, which had fascinated people since Herodotus. When you were there, the shaven-headed priests of Egypt would tell the same sort of bizarre stories that they still tell today. They would be going on about how the pyramids went down into the sand as far as they went up. They would say that one of the pyramids had been financed by the pharaoh prostituting his daughter out. all these sorts of bizarre stories are just passed on.
Now, I got the impression as I was reading your book that sex was a fairly big draw for a lot of these tourists, that for some, they clearly wanted to indulge, and there were places that were famous as erotic hotspots, I guess.
Definitely. I think sex and travel have always been intertwined, actually, and for the Romans, who were a little bit sexually obsessed, it very much was so, and the Bay of Naples was probably the most famous of the places to go. And especially in summer. For example, if you visited the Villa of Tiberius, you could go up there and there would be tours showing around. They're showing the paintings from Elephantus that were on his walls, these erotic paintings, and hear about the Sprintrii, who were his adepts at unnatural practices, and he used to swim in his pools there, and little boys would dress up as minnows, and according to Suetonius, they would swim with him and nibble at his parts as he swam around. But very much so, erotic art was very important. And one of the great erotic pieces was the Aphrodite of Cnidos, which was over in the coast of Asia Minor. And that was one of the great ones to go to. It was actually the first female nude. The most erotic art is really in the brothels of Pompeii have some very, very interesting pieces, actually. In the brothels, they had the little stalls that the women worked in. Above each one was a little painting showing the prostitute's speciality. And those are still there, and they're the most popular things to see in Pompeii. In fact, there's this logjam of people trying to get in and out, you know, jabbering on in all languages, discussing these images. So sex still sells.
Well, did you feel that the world that you were experiencing was anything like the world that these ancient Roman tourists would have seen 2,000 years ago?
Well, I think that the archetypal experiences of travel haven't changed. The technology has, and the physical condition of the sites has obviously changed. But I found that when you ended up in these very unlikely situations, you can't sort of have these connections back to the past. And they would tend to be the more improbable ones, like when we were lost in the mountains of Arcadia, and you're surrounded by mist, and you'd basically be seeing exactly what the Romans would have seen. Or in Egypt as well. Egypt is quite an extraordinary place because what the Romans saw in the 1st and 2nd century ADs, with some exceptions, was very much what we see today. The ruins of Luxor are very much the same now as they were then. The Sphinx, the pyramids are still as amazing now as they were then. There's one that still has its limestone coping. It's called the Bent Pyramid. That's quite an extraordinary experience because when you go out there, it takes a few hours driving through the desert. Nothing around. It's just like barren to the horizon all around. And then it just rises from the road as you're coming down this valley. And it's quite an incredible experience. And even though we were not on camelback, you can still have that imaginative leap and get a feeling for how ancient Roman sightseers, who were, after all, interested in the same things that we were, how it must have been very similar for them.
Tony Paraday's book about traveling like an ancient Roman tourist is called Pagan Holiday. One of the best things about traveling is that feeling of seeing the world as it used to be. That's why some people can't get enough of old stone buildings, ancient temples, and tall ships. Last summer, independent producer Aubrey Ralph spent 9 days living the life of a tall ship sailor, crossing the Great Lakes aboard the USS Niagara. It's a trip he'd dreamed about since he was a child.
Check, check. Climbing aboard Niagara is like stepping behind the velvet ropes at a museum. But this ship is not some dusty artifact. She's alive in black and yellow ochre, smelling richly of wood and tar, rope and canvas.
This is so cool.
Before the Industrial Revolution, sailing ships for commerce or war were the most complicated machines on the planet, and one look is enough to see why. More than 7 miles of rope, like tendons and arteries, run from the deck to her two masts that tower 9 or 10 stories overhead. At about 200 feet long, her size and complexity feel overwhelming.
I looked at a lot of pictures, diagrams of the ship, just studying for what it was going to be like, but that cannot prepare you in any way for seeing the ship firsthand. I mean, it is fantastic. It is just amazing.
Niagara was built quickly to defeat the British, so there is nothing fancy here, nothing but what she needed to fight. 200 years after her war, she's a classroom, keeping age-old maritime arts alive. Her short black cannon now unnervingly cool to the touch. She takes no passengers, so I'm here as student and crew. I've dreamed about sailing on a tall ship my whole life, and the first lessons come fast. On day one, we're told that most of the work of sailing happens on deck, but some jobs can only be done aloft, up in the rigging, among her massive square sails. It's optional for students, but I am climbing.
Now I step on the edge of the hammock here.
Webbed triangular rigging attaches the mast to the sides of the ship.
Right. So I'm gonna climb up with you to where Jill is, and you don't want to hold on to these lines that are running horizontal.
I grab the thick, black vertical lines, and one by one, my feet push up against the thin foot ropes. It's about 45 feet up to the lower of the two platforms. I pause and take in the view, then edge around the mast and climb down the other side. We use safety harnesses when working, and Niagara has other safety measures too. Inflatable rafts, diesel engines, GPS, and radar. But most of the modern things are hidden, preserving the illusion of living in 1813. The ship was built so she could cross a shallow sandbar in the harbor, which didn't leave much room for the crew below decks. This literally hits me in the head as I climb down the steep steps for the first time. The ceiling beams are less than 5 feet off the floor. The 1,000-square-foot space I step into is the berth deck, and it's where about 27 of us will live, professional and student alike, some for months at a time. It's completely sparse, dark wood floors and white walls lined with each sailor's canvas sea bag. There are 40 aboard now, half students, half professionals, but back in 1813, there would have been 155 sailors and soldiers. Believe me, 40 feels very crowded. While the officers and mid-ranks get bunks in the rear half of the ship, the rest of us sleep in stiff canvas hammocks strung from numbered places on the ceiling beams. Everyone gets a designated spot, like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. Getting in takes a little gymnastics. You have to do a kind of pull-up and then slip one leg in at a time. It's comfortable, but a little claustrophobic. The beams are just inches overhead, and the hammocks are strung so close together, it feels like we're all sleeping in one giant bed. It's a little warm, too, but that's about my last thought before sleep washes over me. We sail tomorrow, and my dreams are filled with high sea adventure.
At some point in the night, I had to get up and go to the bathroom, and there was a girl sleeping right under my hammock, so I had to be extra careful getting in there. I was also told that I almost fell out of my hammock last night. Luckily, I don't remember that. Earlier in the day, it was very hot on the berth deck. I don't normally sleep well when it's super hot, but I also don't sleep well falling out of my hammock, and I managed not to do that, so...
On day two, we shove off from the pier, leaving the modern world behind, and fall into the centuries-old rhythm of life on a tall ship. We sail around the clock, and the crew is broken into divisions to cover all the watches or shifts. The watches rotate, so my division works at different times each day and night. Other than hard work, the only constant here are the meals. In 1813, the crew ate a lot of boiled, salted meat, but now, the smells of lasagna or pad thai flow from the galley hatch. The great food is a payoff for the long hours, and so are the breaks in between watches. When not working, some sailors try to catch up on sleep, but others hang out on deck, keeping up the long tradition of music in maritime life. We also use music to set the rhythm for various jobs. One day, working up on the mainsail, I learn a shanty sailors have been singing forever. It's pretty windy, but if you listen close, you can probably make out a few lines.
I'm just a small town girl. No. The world. Took the midnight train going anywhere.
The crew here feel more like siblings than co-workers, and when things get tough, it's that kind of camaraderie that holds us all together, and things can get tough. Today, we don't have to fight the British, but like every ship across time, we do have to fight the weather. It's been cloudy with light rain on and off all day. And around midnight, we sail squarely into a night squall. Heavy clouds block out the stars, so it's almost pitch black. Cold rain beats down on us, stinging my eyes. Not having been here long enough to really know what's going on, I'm a bit disoriented, but ready to do anything asked of me. The first thing we have to do is take in sail, and that sends two of us racing maybe 80 feet up into the darkness. I'm staying firmly on deck. Someone I can barely see passes me lines to haul on. The wet ropes cut into my hands. I pull as hard as I can anyway. For 3 hours, we fight the storm. I'm completely exhausted when we're finally given the okay to go below.
This might be my longest day here. It really makes you appreciate just what these guys do every day.
The first day seemed to last forever, then time just kind of melted, and suddenly the trip is nearly over.
We have a couple of days left of sailing, and it almost breaks my heart that I have to leave this place.
My endpoint is a tall ships festival in Michigan. Niagara joins a parade of sail with the others going into port. Every ship with guns fires them along the way, and ours are by far the biggest and baddest.
Stand by fire!
Stand by fire!
Fire!
Then it's time to say goodbye.
Well, yeah, so again, like, it's been awesome sailing with you guys.
It really has.
Yeah.
I mean it.
Yeah, it's, thank you so much for the experience, and I may try again to come back next summer. So.
Great having you.
Awesome.
That's independent producer Aubrey Ralph from aboard the tall ship USS Niagara. Coming up, a woman, a motorcycle, and the Himalayas. I'm Ann Strange Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Azra Nomani was born in India and raised in West Virginia. She grew up in a Muslim household, but an assignment for the Wall Street Journal led her to study Tantra, an ancient form of yoga. And what started out as an adventure became a spiritual journey. She told me what led her to take a risky trek all alone through the Himalayas.
One of the things that I came to really understand is that fear, you know, so often keeps us in these safe zones, and that I had to overcome my own fears in order to really try to get to know who I was better. And one of the greatest fears in India is the idea of, you know, a woman traveling alone. So many people dissuaded me, and yet I knew that my own independence was critical to my own being. And so, can you imagine? I've never even gotten on anything like more complicated than my Gary Fisher mountain bike, right, in America. I have my driver's license since I was 16, but not a motorcycle license. Never been on one except behind a motorcyclist once. And so I go out and I actually buy a Hero Honda Splendor, like nothing more complicated than a scooter in America. It's 100cc. But it's the man's bike out there. All the thugs have it. All of the young punks have it. And I go out and get this motorcycle. I don't even know how to ride it. I mean, the guy from the dealership has to ride it home for me. I ended up going out and cutting my hair. I had long hair then, and I cut it so that it would be boy length. I wore jeans and pants like I never would otherwise in India, trying to be a modest woman. And I wore a t-shirt and a jacket, and I ended up having to pretend that I was a guy, because if they saw a woman on a motorcycle, that was just like every image that they had of appropriate behavior.
What would happen?
Well, what did happen was, you know, when I would travel through some parts of my home state of Uttar Pradesh, I mean, men would literally like play rabbit with me on the road. They would, you know, get in front of me and then slow down until I passed them. And then they would pass me again. And it's like this ridiculous game.
Were you
scared? I wasn't really frightened, because they just pissed me off. It was basically a safety risk that they were doing. And also, it was just stupid. I mean, it was a sad truth of a state where unemployment's really high. Guys don't have jobs. They don't see women. They're sexually repressed. I mean, there's all of these deep issues, right? I literally, like, at one place, had to fix my rearview mirror, and the crowd gathered around me when I got to the village mechanic. And I had my broken rearview mirror in my hand, and these guys were just bothering me so much. I wailed it at one of them. It was one of my low moments in my life, but I felt like I couldn't take it anymore. And at the end of the day, you know, like, of course they were going to stare. Of course they were going to be watching. I mean, I was completely breaking every stereotype that they'd ever had of what a woman does. And so it wasn't really fair on my part. But, you know, I had our Western sensibilities that, look, I should be allowed to do what I want to do, right? And so I got on that motorcycle and went through the Himalayas and was alone, like we all are on so much of our journeys. I stared at those trucks barreling at me. I would meditate on the image of Durga, this goddess who sits on a tiger. She's beautiful and yet powerful. She slays the demons of evil and delusion. And I would meditate on her image, because the truck drivers all put her on the front of their trucks. And so she would literally be staring me down as I climbed the Himalayas.
Well, it strikes me that a lot of what you were doing was about trying to contain paradoxes within yourself, so that, you know, here you were, a woman dressed as a man on a motorcycle and meditating on a female goddess who embodies great power and great strength.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of paradox and a lot of dualism, I guess.
It was not so much about containing the paradoxes, but of reconciling the paradoxes within me. What is the truth, I think, of all spiritualism is that we are born with these dualities, and we grow up with these dualities, oftentimes defining our lives. You know, we're born a man or we're born a woman, and we think that we have to act a certain way then to fulfill that gender that we're born into. We're born into a religion, and we have to act a certain way. Born into a socioeconomic class. And then these are boundaries at the end of the day. And so what I was trying to do was not just simply be defined by these boundaries and really transcend them and go to the true essence of who I was then.
Was this idea about boundaries, was this more powerful for you, do you think, because you'd grown up in an immigrant family, you'd grown up both American and Indian?
I thought so, and I thought that, you know, the message of my book was one that, you know, a white male wouldn't be able to understand. Then, you know, I thought about it, and it applies to everybody. Everybody's got the same stuff happening to them. They're all living with some kind of expectations of how they're supposed to live their lives, how they're supposed to love, how they're supposed to, you know, be on this earth.
So in the meantime, on this trip, you were still in some ways looking for love. And eventually in Pakistan, you wound up meeting a Muslim man, and you did fall in love. What happened?
Well, I thought that he, too, was, you know, going to be the answer to this dissonance that was within me. He was a very Western, modern man. He had his own bootlegger, right, in the middle of Karachi, where alcohol is illegal. He was living the life of any, you know, Manhattan young man, and working on the Wall Street of Karachi. And yet he was a Muslim. He fasted. He went to the Friday prayer. And I thought he was the answer, you know, to me in this conflict that I had between the West and Islam. And I fell in love. I fell in love hard. And so it was while America was bombing Afghanistan then. It was right after September 11th, and I'd gone to Karachi, and last thing I expected was to fall in love. But I did, and I think he fell in love also, and he talked marriage and talked future and babies and life and love and all the dreams, right?
And so here you're thinking, this is the end point of your quest, right? Here you started out researching Tantra, the sort of philosophy of divine love, and you realized that you needed to find yourself before you could truly love anybody else, and you had this incredible, chaotic, scary trip across, but fulfilling trip across India, and it must have seemed like, I did it. I've, you know, found myself, and here's my reward, this great guy.
Yeah, I was literally, you know, writing the last chapters of Tantrika when September 11th happened, and then I put my pen aside to go to Pakistan to report as a journalist from there. And so when I fell in love, I thought, I've got it. I've got the last chapter. This is so great. You know, I went out looking for divine love and I found it. Like, how exciting is that? But then, you know, the thing that I learned, which is the truth of all spiritual pursuits, is that you have to be able to distinguish delusion from reality. And so this is the great concept of Durga, the idea of slaying delusion. Sometimes it slays you first, right? And that's what happened to me, where just like with just love calculated incorrectly, he wasn't everything that I thought he was going to be.
Well, in fact, he failed you. I mean, betrayed you.
Yeah. I was there in Pakistan, and I'd been a Wall Street Journal reporter for 15 years, and one of my best friends was Danny Pearl. I started renting a house in Karachi, and Danny came with his wife for an interview that Danny had scheduled in Karachi. And then, as the world knows, he didn't return. Marianne and I started that night on this month-long search to try to find him. And my boyfriend was there, but then he never returned because Pakistani intelligence paid him a visit, and he was too afraid to you know, stay with me. And so it broke my heart, but, you know, I had to keep trying to find Danny, right? I couldn't just chase after this guy. At the end of the day, he walked away from us in our greatest time of need. And yeah, and then I got a little surprise in the middle of our search.
Well, the surprise was that you were pregnant. And then you told your boyfriend, and he walked away because you'd broken in his eyes all the Indian traditions of marriage and pregnancy. This must have been such a turbulent time for you.
You know, when I had set off on this journey, my friend from Nepal had turned to me and he had said, Asra, you know, be careful. It's a dangerous world. And that was, you know, something that I could never have predicted would play out like it did in my life. But the truth of a lot of spiritual journeys, I think, is that you must proceed carefully because there is darkness that you're going to encounter. But yes, in fact, there can be light. And that light, I was so blessed, you know, had found its way into me physically. I was carrying a baby. I mean, I had never expected anything like that in my life. And it was probably a blessing that allowed me to survive the horror of then finding out that Danny had been murdered. And so Marianne and I both left Pakistan, basically single mothers, and now are raising both little boys, separated only by a few months. And it's in moments of recognition like that when I can see, you know, what came out of all of that, that I know that the struggle is worth it.
Asra Nomani's book about her journey is called Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. One rainy, cold December day in London, philosopher Alain de Botton was struck by a travel poster of palm trees, sunlight, and a glistening beach. And he began to wonder, why do we have such an appetite for adventure? And why do so many artists and writers seem almost to live on the road? De Botton's reflections inspired a book called The Art of Travel, and he started off telling Steve Paulson about some famously nomadic artists, the American painter Edward Hopper and the French poet Charles Baudelaire.
I think Baudelaire and Hopper are fascinating characters because, like a lot of us, they preferred being on the road to going anywhere in particular. They were great fans of places that I guess are sort of in-between places, places like diners, motels, hotels, railway stations, airports nowadays, harbours, the kind of places where everyone is on the road, you know, no one is at home. And I think a lot of people find a certain charm to these places that aren't necessarily beautiful from a kind of architectural point of view. Often the food is lousy and whatever. But I think it's the idea that, you know, in these places, everyone is an outsider. And often when we're in our own districts and our own homes and workplaces, there's an idea of community there that we don't really fit in with. Taking to the road and hanging out in deserted motels and all that kind of paraphernalia of the road, that can be a terrific source of relief.
But what's so striking about Hopper's paintings in particular is the loneliness that you see in a lot of those images.
One could say, well, you know, his canvases seem a little bit bleak and depressing, and people just sitting around in diners looking sad. But his art reminds us of a kind of curious lesson, which is that if we're trying to be happy or improve our mood, often we don't need to hear anything optimistic. It's quite nice to find solace in the arms or canvases of a rather pessimistic artist.
Another French writer you write about is Flaubert, who detested France, the sort of the bourgeoisie, that smugness and prudery that he was so familiar with, and he really fell in love with Egypt, but it was kind of a romanticized version of Egypt, wasn't it?
Well, I think Flaubert is an interesting character that I discuss in my book as an example of how we can fall in love with other countries. As you say, he lived in France but felt desperately attracted to Egypt from a very young age and spent a lot of time traveling around the country. And there's a very moving letter where he says, you know, we should stop saying that nationality is something that should automatically be ascribed on the basis of where someone was born. You know, what about saying that people really belong in the countries that they love? And making, you know, the country you're attracted to the real country to which you belong. And I think that's a great motive for traveling. You know, when we travel, we try and get in touch with qualities that exist in other countries, but maybe are not so present in our own.
So what did Flaubert like so much about Egypt?
Well, I think, you know, the process by which Flaubert fell in love with Egypt is the process by which a lot of us fall in love with other countries. What he liked in Egypt was things that were missing, he felt, in his own country. And he found in Egypt a kind of open-mindedness, a colorfulness, a sense of danger, an investment in culture, all of these things that were missing in 19th century France, and he looked to Egypt to provide him with. But, you know, I think we should bear in mind that the idea of the exotic, or rather the quality of the exotic, isn't just limited to places like Egypt. I remember once I'd been on vacation in Egypt, and I was flying back to London. And I remember as the plane was coming down through the clouds, and it was an August, very, very grey, rainy day, as there often are in England. And I was talking to an Egyptian man next to me, and I said to him, you know, I apologize for the weather. It really, really is horrible. And he said, no, these clouds are so exotic for me. And, you know, these dark green fields, it's all so exotic. And of course, you know, for me, it had been the sand that was exotic and the pyramids, but for him, it was a dark rain cloud. So I think that's a fascinating thing, you know, to ask someone, what's the country that you find exotic? Because that's a really interesting way into someone's psychology, really.
Now, all the people we've been talking about so far were pretty much city people. I mean, they thrived on the urban environment and the excitement there. But you also write about Wordsworth, the great English poet who really detested cities.
That's right. I mean, ever since the early 20th century, most of the population of the developed countries around the world has been urban. You know, most of us live in cities. And so for many of us, to take a vacation means to go into nature, to go into the countryside. And in one of the chapters of my book, I ask a very sort of blunt and large question, which is, what's the point of nature? And most of the time, that question is either considered too obvious even to be considered, or else it's answered in very practical terms. It's answered in sort of physical terms. You know, nature is good for you because it's good to get out and stretch your legs and breathe some clean air and that sort of thing. But the reason I was interested in Wordsworth is he's one of the few people to come up with a psychological explanation of why nature is a good thing. And to summarize, you know, hugely, I think what Wordsworth thought was good about nature is that he felt it was very good if you're feeling envious. He thinks that, you know, if you live in a city, you're constantly comparing yourself to other human beings. You're constantly looking at who has more than you or who has less. And you can get that kind of hothouse atmosphere of a city. And what's good to do in nature is that nature reminds you that there are lots of things beyond the human. There are lots of animals and trees and vegetation that just goes on without any reference to us. And so it's a real relief from that kind of egocentric concern that makes day-to-day life often quite unbearable in a big city.
Now, we've talked about a lot of famous writers and painters. There's one person you end your book with who's not so famous, a Frenchman who wrote something called Journey Around My Bedroom.
That's right. He's one of the odder characters of the history of French literature, but I think a very, very charming and interesting man, interesting writer. His name was Xavier de Maistre, and he was writing at the end of the 18th century. And he was writing at just the time when sort of mass tourism was getting going. A lot of people were traveling far and fast. And this kind of urge to travel always to very, very exotic places annoyed Xavier de Maistre, because he felt that really what identifies a good traveler is not so much an enthusiasm for going far, but a way of looking at things. You know, what makes a good traveler is the ability to look at things in a close and attentive way and appreciate the surroundings. And he felt that this is something you can do in your own district as much as, you know, in very, very faraway places. That's why he encouraged us maybe to even travel around our own bedrooms. He said, you know, if you traveled around your own bedroom, maybe that's as interesting as the Himalayas or the jungles of South America.
I have a hard time believing that, but anyway.
Right. Well, I think he's pushing to an extreme, to an absurd extreme, what is actually a very sensible point, which, as I say, it's all about remaining receptive to places. It's not just about traveling, you know, huge distances. So he wrote this book, Journey Around My Bedroom, in which he travels around his bedroom and rediscovers its many charms. And the book was a big bestseller when it was published, and he wrote a follow-up called Journey to My Windowsill, in which he travels to the windowsill. I mean, it sort of sounds silly, but I think, you know, there's a truth in it. If you imagine the average city is going to have people in it who live there, and people who live in a city frequently don't really look at their own city. They don't look around. It's just home, and it's quite dull, and they keep their heads down when they go to work, and you know they don't look around themselves so much. And then in the very same city, there'll be people who are tourists, and the tourists are going to be there with, you know, their cameras and their eyes wide open, and they're going to be checking everything out, and they're going to be full of curiosity. And of course, the place that these two groups of people are in is exactly the same. What's different is the kind of mindset. And so I think that really captures what Xavier de Maistre was getting at, that the travel might be more about a process of looking and appreciating than about a process of going far. And, you know, your own home city, which after all is the tourist destination for many other people, you know, could have many, many charms and sources of interest that you haven't yourself fathomed yet.
Alain de Botton's book is called The Art of Travel. That's it for today's travel stories, but you can find more on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, Karen Russell's got a bookmark for you. And what's a neighborhood to do with ugly, abandoned railway lines? We'll celebrate the 5th anniversary of New York's High Line Park. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Karen Russell. I'm the author of Sleep Donation and Vampires in the Lemon Grove. And my bookmark is A High Wind in Jamaica by Richard Hughes. This is one of my favorite novels. It's a totally sui generis original tale about the Bass Thornton siblings. These are these children who come from 19th century Jamaica. They're more or less feral children there. There's a terrific storm that destroys their house, Ferndale, and so their concerned parents decide that the best thing for them will be to send them back to London, which exists for these children as sort of like a mythical place, the home that they've never been to. So they board a ship. They're very excited to have this seafaring adventure. The ship is taken over by pirates, and they're abducted. So this makes it sound like sort of some Peter Pan adventure tale. And it's really excitingly dark. I mean, it really takes everybody's Victorian notions of the child and innocence and upends them. I think that there are a lot of readers that somehow aren't so familiar with it. The New York Review of Books recently reissued it with a fabulous introduction by Francine Prose. For me, I think, as a lover of sibling tales, what's really exciting is seeing that mental threshold between childhood and adulthood represented in sort of the the best vessel I can imagine, which is just this pirate ship that's sort of floating lost at sea between continents. And the children love the pirates, and the pirates, they're occasionally tenderhearted towards the children, occasionally brutal and arbitrarily savage. The children, too, in no way conform to what we want to romanticize and fetishize childhood to be. They endure all kinds of violence, and it affects them in sort of indiscriminate ways. Different events make it into memory. Some events just, they, you know, calve them like glaciers, and they never make it into the children's recorded history. And it's also simply a lot of fun to get these kids' view of the adults. There's one of my favorite scenes. The pirates are drinking grog. All of these adults are sort of in a stuporous, drunken haze, and the children, who have never seen anything like this, just believe that the adults are putting a spell on themselves, you know? So it's sort of like getting an alien observer's take on adult customs and propriety and things like drinking, which is really wild and hilarious. I first read it after I had written Swamplandia. Somebody couldn't believe I had never read A High Wind in Jamaica. It's one of my favorites, and then immediately went back to the beginning. I mean, I had to read it again that day. I didn't want to leave the world of this book.
Karen Russell recommends A High Wind in Jamaica by Richard Hughes. You'll find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. Have you been to the High Line yet? It's one of Manhattan's newest parks, and in the summer, it's full of sunbathers, lush plantings, and strolling locals. It's also about 30 feet above the ground, built on the bed of an old elevated train line. Since the first section opened a little over 5 years ago, the High Line has been widely praised for its innovative reuse of old industrial infrastructure. Writer Anique Lafarge lives close to the park, and she's written a guidebook to the High Line and its history. Producer Sarah Nix talked with her this spring and asked her how often she visits.
I was actually on the High Line yesterday afternoon, and it's a really interesting time to be on the High Line right now because the annual spring cutback recently happened. The High Line, unlike most gardens, is not cut back in the fall. So after the cutback, at around this time of year, before the plants start to fill out again, what you really see on the High Line is the railroad infrastructure that Friends of the High Line and its design team saved when they built the park.
So what does that original infrastructure look like?
Well, to kind of understand the High Line today, you have to go back kind of a long time, about almost 100 years ago. Railroads were the main transportation source for goods and produce into the city. And the West Side was a very heavily industrial area, and it ran right next to the Hudson River. And so you had all the ships coming in, and there was this real marriage of river and rail. And so the High Line, when it was built, it was a very unique, modern form of transportation that allowed the trains to run past factories and warehouses, and trains could just pull off, veer off from the track onto a little spur and deliver their goods and then just keep on going.
And it's some 30 feet off the street level, right?
Yeah, and it's usually, most parts of the High Line are about 30 feet wide, but there are some areas that are a little bit wider.
The last train that rolled down those rails was in 1980, I think.
Yes, correct.
But someone mentioned to me recently that, of course, the spur was built, the elevated rail was built to last for centuries. So what happened to it when it stopped being used for trains?
Well, the last train, as you mentioned, ran in 1980. As soon as the train stopped running on the High Line, the viaduct kind of fell into a quiet state of nature. And a wild garden grew up, all kinds of plants. There were, when somebody did a survey in 2000, early 2000s, of the flora on the High Line, they found 160 different species. So many different plants came to the High Line because they would hitchhike like a little seed hobo. They'd hitchhike a ride on a railroad train that came, say, from the heartland. So you had all these grasses from the prairies of Nebraska. They would come in all manner of ways from all over the country. And so this really beautiful wild garden grew up there. And the High Line was abandoned. It was defunct. It was illegal to trespass on it, but a lot of people did. And it began to be torn down. The southern part of the High Line was torn down in the 1990s. But the rest of the viaduct stood, and a lot of people wanted to tear it down. So there was a big debate in the neighborhood. And in 1999, two men, Robert Hammond and Joshua David, met at a community board meeting, and they decided that they wanted to preserve it.
You write that it took a decade to realize that project. What were some of the challenges to it?
Well, there were a lot of stakeholders that they had to negotiate with. There was the very considerable cadre of owners of property who own the real estate underneath the High Line.
Oh, they were probably hoping to cash in.
Yeah, they were. They wanted to develop. There's a lot of development going on, obviously, all over New York City, and they wanted to develop their land underneath the High Line.
So eventually, the project was approved, and a team of landscape architects and plant specialists won the design competition. What was their plan to transform the old rail line?
So the team that won, James Corner Field Operations, Dilla Scafidio and Renfro, with Pete Outolf doing the plant design, what they set about doing was coming up with a plan to transform the High Line into this series of episodic events that would preserve a lot of the history of the park. And one of the major things in the story was when Robert Hammond, one of the co-founders of Friends of the High Line, brought Joel Sternfeld, who was one of the great landscape photographers, up there and asked him to take pictures for a marketing brochure.
And this was before they had done any work, right? This was when it was still in this kind of disrepair, wild state.
That was in 2000. And he went up there and he was really gobsmacked by what he saw. And he shot for a whole year. And those photographs really turned out to be, they set the tone for everything that came afterwards because they so defined this really beautiful, wild landscape in an urban setting. And so when the design team set about their planning and their laying out their design ideas for the park, that was very much at the center of their thinking, was to preserve the horticultural aspect of that. They tried to use a lot of the same kinds of plants that had grown on the High Line. Actually, when they built the park, they had to pull everything out for asbestos remediation and other industrial kind of pollutants that had over the years, because it was an industrial site, had contaminated the rail bed. But they put a lot of it back. And what it looks like now is it's a meandering path that runs for about a mile and a half. And it was designed to be a very episodic landscape. You start in a woodland in the southern part of the park. You approach a bog at around 14th Street. There's a grassland called the Chelsea Grassland between 16th Street and 20th Street. And then you walk through this wonderful little area. It's like a little secret magical garden. It's called the Chelsea Thicket, that is filled with very tall trees and really erases the city for about a block and a half or so.
Hmm. So is there one point along that mile and a half stretch of the High Line that to you kind of sums up the thinking that went into how they were going to develop the project?
Yeah. The grasslands is a really good example, the Chelsea grasslands. When you walk through, particularly this time of year after the plants have been cut back and you can really see the tracks, you can actually see stamped into the rails Bethlehem Steel or Erie Lackawanna. The paving system was designed so that the gardens, the plants, would just come up through. They're like fingers that kind of disappear into the plantings. And so as you're walking along, you feel the garden growing up organically around you. And there's all these really wonderful juxtapositions of hard and soft. You have the hard pavement, the steel rails, but all these very beautiful soft plants, lots of different colors. So you really have you're walking through a very varied landscape in the middle of a city. I mean, the really extraordinary thing, the astounding thing of walking through the High Line is that there you are 30 feet above the city street, walking between buildings, seeing this view, this unobstructed view, with no fear of getting hit by a crazy taxi driver.
And there's even this moment, I'm not quite sure where it is, where there's an amphitheater that's built kind of at an intersection, and there's a cinematic view in front of you of the city. It's a streetscape, essentially.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's like an only in New York moment where, I mean, who would build a giant window so that people could sit and look at traffic, except in New York City? So there you sit in these stadium seats, and you look, and people do, and it's always crowded. Lovers sit and hold hands and look out the window and gaze at traffic. It's unlike any other place I've ever seen before.
The High Line has been celebrated as one of the great urban projects of the last decade. You know, it's part public art, it's part urban planning. Do you think people who are maybe dubious about the project have changed their minds about it now that they've seen it in action?
Well, there are people who regret the transformation of the neighborhood that the High Line is in. Of course, the High Line, the neighborhood was changing before the High Line was built and opened. It was already starting to become, for instance, a magnet for art galleries. And so the neighborhood was very vibrant before the High Line came, but it has all this construction going on. There's an enormous amount of gentrification. And, you know, when Robert and Josh first started thinking about the High Line, they were thinking that it would be mostly an asset used by the community. I mean, they thought that 300,000 people maximum would come a year. They get 4 million now. So they never expected that it would be this successful. But I think that, you know, it's become a real model for adaptive reuse of former industrial infrastructure all over this country and all over the world. So there are projects in cities everywhere that are inspired by the High Line.
Such as what?
Well, there's a project in Chicago. It's called the 606, and it's also a former elevated rail line. I think it's about 3 miles, and it's under construction now. I mean, there's a great project in Atlanta. It's not elevated. It's called the Beltline, but it was also made from an old railroad. Basically, it was a ring around the city of Atlanta, 22 miles. What's interesting about that project is that it connects as many as 45 different neighborhoods. In Philadelphia, there is a project that's getting a lot of traction called the Reading Viaduct. That project is interesting because there's also a long section that runs at grade and below grade, even through a tunnel. So that will be a very different kind of project.
That's Anique Lafarge talking about New York's Aerial Greenway. Her guidebook is called On the High Line. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Sarah Nix produced today's show with help from Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.